Hello, everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap. It's the last day of May of 2017, and it's time for Weekly Manga Recap. How you doing, Chris?
I'm doing very good, Nick. I have a bit of a story to share with you. So this kind of needs a little bit of setup. So previously in Weekly Manga Recap opening tangents, I'm no longer working for the state. I mentioned that previously. Left the state. Right. I'm going to be going to school in the summer semester. And to work with that, I had to kind of pick up a part-time job, essentially, in the interim. And it's a position at a grocery store, essentially at a stocking area. And it's actually something I really enjoy, ability to kind of be on your feet all the time, moving around. It really helps me more than a desk job. And I was in the back room helping the assistant store manager. It's the first time I've met this guy, essentially like one of the highest positions in the store. He's doing something busy, and he's basically moving some pieces around in the back room so that they can wax this area. So I go down to pick up about three boxes, and these are not boxes filled with heavy items, but they're boxes of damaged items, so they're all of an irregular weight, not like proportionally spread out, and I won't try to act as though I'm not at fault for this, but I eat shit carrying these boxes. I butt fumble it all over. They just flop out of my hand, like three boxes up in the air. Everything in them starts going flying. And it's all in front of this assistant store manager.
Who you're meeting for the first time.
Essentially meeting him for the first time.
Who's this clumsy idiot? Yeah.
Yeah. And my instantaneous response to this was to say, I'm sorry, my dad never taught me how to play catch. And he said nothing. He immediately just turned around, went the other way. He was very busy. He had so much more things to do. But I sat there for about 5 minutes because, like, oh my God, this says so much about me, and that I've just learned in this one moment that in this one moment I've attached so much of myself to this one instance. There's so much for me to dig. Like, I was like, hold on, can I get a cup of coffee? I need to sit down here for a little bit and like take a nap. Let me process a couple things. Like maybe get like a round table, like therapist maybe pop in here.
It's almost like a, it's kind of like a avant-garde film moment.
Yeah, as I'm sitting there, I'm like, maybe this is a little bit of catch. I wouldn't be so clumsy if my dad had just taught me how to play catch more often.
Falling one broken shard of a glass can't go. I'm getting slow motion spinning through the air.
Like, I'm just
you're a normal potion while all the items are in slow motion.
Just to like, just suddenly as though, like, I have, like, my feet, like, underneath, like, a pile of marbles. Like, I'm, like, the mini dinosaurs in Godzilla, the movie, like, the American version that are just, like, falling on marbles. Like, he said nothing to me afterwards, by the way. I saw him a couple other times, did not mention it up. I can guarantee, though, this has become the story in whatever, like, high executive locker room grocery store thing they have, where they're just like, so, met the new guy, ate shit carrying a bunch of boxes, then just dropped his daddy issues on me. I don't know what that's about, but watch this, kid. He might be a loose cannon. I don't know.
Don't put too much pressure on him, okay?
Yeah. Let's keep him away from any high-stress situations.
With sharp objects, you know.
I can't take my box cutter away from me. I need those to open up the Gatorades.
Don't take my box cutter. If you take away my box cutter, I'll burn down the building.
I don't know what to do without my box cutter. God, if only my dad had taught me to play catch! They're like, sir,
my dad had taught me how to cut things.
Sir, you can't keep using your dad as an excuse for all your problems. I wouldn't have so many problems if my dad taught me to play catch.
If only my dad had taught me how to get a promotion. Okay. That said, we do have a bunch of manga to freaking talk about this week. So, no more tangents until we get to actually talking about My Hero Academia and the rest of the manga, because we've got 11 different chapters to talk about this week. We had two different chapters that we never learned. Astra is back this week, so let's just get into it. We're going to be here a while.
Yepers.
All right. I'm going to start off with My Hero Academia, number 139, Shudder, the Underground Labyrinth, which that is a title that could only, you know, happen in freaking manga and anime titles, isn't it? Because it's so weird.
Yeah.
What does Shuddering have to do with Underground Labyrinths? Nothing.
It just sounds catchy and sexy as a name.
Shudder. So, the heroes are invading the A-Precept's base, trying to retrieve Aerie and so on. The group is of course split up because there is a group dealing with the people outside. And last time we were introduced to the bullets of the priest's death. So we get a little bit of banter going on amongst the heroes as they're running along, wondering what the heck, is going on with, the guards, how they end up in this situation. And, so essentially what Aizawa concludes is, well, the underlings are kind of really old school because this was a Yakuza group. So they're very loyal and, they probably understand the situation a lot more than we're giving them credit for, essentially. And, so yeah, Aizawa was the smart one basically because of this process.
Makes sense.
Yeah. We do get a little detail with Sir Nighteye, who actually has found the secret passage using his foresight ability, which is a cool little detail showing that yes, he did actually gain quite valuable information from using it on the guy in the toy store. He still didn't need to buy that doll, though.
Yeah, that's the very necessary part.
Bubble Girl and Centipede spring into action in order to take on some of the goons that spring out of the secret passage. And we actually get to see what they're able to do. Centipede can apparently just, I guess maybe his entire body is one long centipede thing? It's hard to tell, really.
Quirk, centipede, centicoil, so, I don't know, maybe he can make 100 arms, or...
Maybe extend centipede tendrils from his body.
Or maybe he can extend his arms centipede distance, so some increment of 100 that we don't know, because we obviously use a different measurement than the rest of the world. I'm like, inches! The rest of the world's like, what the fuck's an inch? Use a real measurement.
And then we get to Bubble Girl, using her bubble quirk, which is apparently just like the bubble attack from Pokemon. Just like,
yeah. Except in Pokemon, the impression you get is that they are blowing bubbles at you. So at least there's some kind of force behind it, even if it's the simple breath. This is just like bubbles like pop off my body. And like this dude was just an idiot. He's like, I got bubble in my eye.
And seriously, what kind of a character uses bubble powers without bending over to show off her ass while they launch backwards from her skates?
Yeah.
There's no sense.
If they're not spinning fast enough, they can't cut steel, Nick. I don't understand it. Bubble Girl's worthless.
I mean, we don't get any explanations for either of their quirks, so it's kind of implied that Bubble Girl's quirk is actually not incredibly impressive, because she takes the guy down with, just like hand-to-hand combat after that, if using her bubble as a distraction, and that's it.
I'm trying to think, because I've been playing a lot of, like, Marvel and DC-related games and following the universe, and, you know, I've noted that in a lot of those universes and things like that, there are the specifically non, like, superpowered superheroes. You're Batman, I guess Iron Fist technically has the superpower, but Green Arrow. Your characters who are like, I'm a martial arts character, or I use gadgets and stuff like that. I know they have mentioned like gadget-based characters, but I was wondering if there's just specifically characters like, I don't really have much of a quirk, but I just, you know, I'm still a superhero because I do. It's like, is that what Bubble Girl is? She's like, yeah, I have a shitty quirk where I can make bubbles, but I'm also like a 10th level black belt taekwondo supermaster or martial arts or something like that.
So, I mean, we have apparently gotten an explanation for Bubble's powers before, which is that she fills them with an aroma, which she can weaponize, but clearly she's just kind of has to make up for a relatively weak quirk with this training, so.
Maybe she could be like Usopp with the dials, though, I guess, like, you know, if you fill it up with a particular kind of gas, kind of like he did in that fight against Luffy.
But we've seen other heroes do this as well, so... Yeah, you know, they don't have an especially powerful quirk, so they supplement it with hand-to-hand combat training, so. The group splits up even further as a result of this because, Centipede and, Bubble Girl stay behind while more of the heroes move forward. They encounter a dead end in the basement right away. And so Mirio, is just like, hang on guys, I'll take a look. And just goes, sticks his head through the wall.
It's actually, there's one thing that's interesting about it, because they do explain, they make the joke immediately, like, no, all your clothes will fall off. And they're like, no, his costume's made out of his, like, you know, it's combined with his hair, so that way it doesn't actually pop off. But he does take his helmet off, so I guess his helmet isn't made out of his hair?
I guess not.
Which,
well, you can't really make a helmet with hair, so Yeah.
But I'm like, to that point, I'm like, then why wear a helmet at all?
Because it looks cool, Chris.
I guess that's the sole reason for it. I'm like, I feel like you would just always be taken off. It'd be more of a distraction than anything else.
So he takes a look around, and he's like, yeah, this is where we've got to go. And so Deku and Kirishima are just like, okay, let's just go through the wall. And they do. But as they step through the hole in the wall, and Centipede and Ghoul Girl, I guess, catch up with them?
I guess, yeah, they managed to get their way in.
I don't even know if they actually left them behind. I guess not. Oh, no, they did leave them behind, but I guess they just got stuck on the wall and then got up to them that way. But the floor starts to distort. The entire hallway gets very, very wavy and weird looking. It's a really disorienting shot, honestly, of the whole place. And so they're like, oh, well, it must be the HQ director, Irinaka. And so what they explain is, yeah, he can mimic stuff. He can control things from the inside by bonding with them. But they're like, but normally he can't do something this ridiculous. So clearly they're like, okay, he must have shaken something in order to boost his powers. And yeah, it is quite reminiscent of, oh, so he's Pika then. But that's a timing issue, I guess.
I think it's... You can't.
It's
really,
not an
you can't give Oda the sole ownership of the ability to reshape things. I mean,
that was just a relatively recent example in shonen manga. So, there is an odd little shot of the guy's cowl. I'm not sure if that's like him pressing himself to the body, or if he's like melted out of his own body or something.
I would assume it's maybe he's discarded it. Like, he's just rid himself of his robe, maybe? Maybe that's how he has to do it? Like, that's how he can get into it and start reshaping things?
Moves into items, yeah. It's hard to... It's kind of hard to tell what this is meant to be implying. It could be... I think it could be either one.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow. So, everyone's like, well, crap. I mean, he can just turn the entire building against us then. And they're like, hey, Aizawa, can you... Can't have that ability. He's like, I can't see the guy's actual body, so no. So Sun Eater starts to go all game over man on everybody. He really starts to freak out about this, and he says, oh gosh, we've got no way out. We've got no way out of here. We've got no way through this. The bad guy's going to have all the time in the world in order to get out of here. So we can't even think about, you know, saving a little girl when we can't even care for ourselves. And Mirio's like, ah, come on, Tamaki, this isn't like you! You're a Sun Eater! He's like, actually, have you met him? He's doom and gloom all the time, Mirio.
It's like, this fits him exactly.
But he immediately springs into action, and he says, okay, look, we can get through this, and anyway, I know you guys have to deal with this, but there's no time to lose, so I'm going on ahead. And he just starts going through the distorting walls, and says, I'll see you guys on the other side. And Tamaki has a bit of a, oh my god, what's wrong with me? You know, Mirio is springing into action, you know, and meanwhile I'm sitting here freaking out. This is my character growth chapter! Yay! Irinaka realizes, well shit, I can't stop that guy. Oh well, I'll just focus on the rest of the group. And he caves in the floor underneath the main group, drops them into a room below where they're confronted by several members of the Bullets. And Fat Gum is like, all right, well, let's show them what us pros can do. But Tamaki steps in and says, nah, you guys are essential to the mission. You guys have to go on ahead because they're just bent on slowing us down. I'll deal with them myself. So Sun Eater is looking like he's going to get to make up for having his power stolen in the last encounter.
So this is interesting. Now, one thing to note is I don't believe that we were meant to insinuate that, and I just forgot his name, but the guy who could shape stuff, he wasn't listed as being one of the eight Bullets. So
that's correct.
The idea being there's probably some level of group beyond the Eight Bullets, because the few characters we have seen.
The real!
Yeah, I would not be surprised if that happens. But this does seem to lend a little bit of credence to it if this is indeed the notion that, the Sasuke character, whose name I've also just forgotten in this moment. Sunny Eater, I should just say his character name. I don't know why I always try to think of their real names. Japanese is not my strong suit. Sun Eater, is potentially going to take out three of them on his own. I mean, I'm all for that. I definitely like his quirk. I think it's a really inventive one. They teased also at the beginning when Fat Gums gave him a specific recommendation of something to eat ahead of time.
Swordfish.
And yeah, oh, yeah. And it would be very relevant to have him get his moment to really shine in doing this and defeating three of them would be good. And I also mentioned last time, I didn't think many of the designs in the group were all that stellar. So having three relatively disposable guys defeated to buff up one of your big three, like one of the more significant characters introduced recently, is a good idea. I do hope, though, if that is the case, we've already seen Mirio do very awesome things. We saw him essentially solo Class A. But I do hope then that the female character, whose name I am legitimately forgetting right now, I do hope she gets something, because as of right now, her and the rest of that entire group are out fighting just one of the Eight Bullets.
They're just stuck outside, yeah.
So I hope that she gets something to also keep her at that same level, because if you're going to take a big kind of point to emphasize two members of the big three and give them their own moves look really cool, she should get one too, because that's the point of having them all kind of establish at being at the same level.
Yes. And I think that a lot of this is kind of built around the idea that, you know, we're kind of seeing a preview of how Deku and his friends are eventually going to turn out when they've gained more experience. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
But I like this chapter. I'm excited to see what happens with Sun Eater next, and it was all in all very fun.
Yeah, Mimic guy is not one of the displayed guys in the Eight Bullets. So it does seem as though there is a bit of a different levels of disposability within the group.
Mm. All right. So we need to move on to Fairy Tail.
Okay.
Chapter 537, The Power of Life. Now, Nick.
Are you sure it's not The Power of Love, Chris?
Nick, last time I told you, Nick, bite your tongue, Nick. Because there are 10 chapters.
There's no way that this is ending this
Nick! Way. Nick, there's no way that both Xerath and Akalogia are both defeated when there are 10 chapters of this series at least left that we have still a lot to get through. Nick, there is no way Natsu defeated the biggest antagonist of this series with simply just a punch with his quote-unquote savage emotions. There is no way. This chapter begins with Xerath being like, I've been defeated.
Oh.
I'm done.
Savage emotions.
You've defeated me. I'm done. And at first, I was following along with this because we had a couple people who tweeted us mentioning like, oh, you're gonna be really angry at this week. So I had an inkling that I was like, oh, they're going to, it's gonna be that route, isn't it? It's actually going to be that they're done. Now we don't know both, but this chapter deals specifically with Xerath and Mavis, who I've never been the biggest fans of. Their relationship has kind of been told in pieces throughout Fairy Tail, and then right. I guess a portion of it was also through the side story that I just never read. So there's not as much of a connection with everyone else. But essentially, it just starts with Xerath complimenting him. He's like, oh man, he beat me, but hey, he's underestimating. I can, you know, revive in just a little bit and I'll be completely healed.
Just need to, you know, get a good night's sleep and my HP will gradually go up.
Yeah, I just gotta pop off for 6 hours, get an extended rest, all my spell slots back.
Ding, ding, dee doo ding.
We'd hit that with a myriad of nerdy references.
Take your pick.
Yeah. Mavis, however, will not have that.
Mavis is like, this area isn't safe, you can't sleep here.
And just like, god damn it, is there still a cliff racer chasing me? She says, no, you made all my friends suffer, you've hurt them, you've hurt everyone in this guild, I'm very angry at you. But she says, like, hey, you know, I still like you, you can finally rest now, and I wish I had trusted you back then, and killed you when you killed me, essentially. We found out that that curse of contradiction would allow us to kill one another, and I didn't do it with you, essentially. Not like that. That'd be weird. But I didn't.
But apparently they did it, so.
Yeah. I didn't actually murder you at the same time or whatever. And she notes that, oh, it must have been my own doubt. I must not have trusted in you fully. The power of my love was not strong enough.
Don't need money. Don't take fame. Don't need a credit card to ride this train. Go ahead.
Live it in America. That's not the song.
It's strong in its own. It's cruel sometimes. When I just save your life, it's the power of love.
Cash was everything around me. Dollar bill, y'all. All right. So, we're going to be short on time this week because we have a lot of different series to talk about. So I won't go through every little point that Mavis has with Xerf, but I will say this. I have not been a huge fan of these two and their relationship, but I will not let that take away from the fact that I do think if you are someone who is invested in the two of these characters, this does seem to be an emotionally satisfactory conclusion to them. You do get them expressing earnest feelings towards one another. I do feel like there's earned emotion here, if only because Xerf hasn't been one of the few conflicts that Fairy Tail hasn't solved immediately upon encountering it. This is something that has had time to build up, and I imagine this feels satisfying to get sort of these emotions said between these characters.
It's a complicated thing that they're going for, because, mm-hmm. I mean, and the way that Mavis is addressing it, it's interesting, because she's saying, like, you've done all these horrible things, I hate you, but at the same time, you know, her true feelings shine through because she does actually love him. And it's an interesting kind of conflict, and it does tie into the contradiction of the curse that they share. But it's, I don't know. On a basic, there is just something that is just kind of really wrong seeming about it. You know, like, oh, but she still loves him deep down despite all the horrible things that she did. It's like, and there are some very unfortunate implications of that that are all too easy to get. Mm-hmm. And so there's some good about it, but there's a very underlying bad thing about it that I don't like.
There are some definitely unfortunate parts of it, but it does kind of lead to this conflict where she's screaming for him to die, but ultimately she doesn't want him to. And she gives him a kiss, and Xerf says, I'm very happy now, and it's all because of you. I think I can sleep now. And there's this giant beam of light that comes down and engulfs the two of them. And they go off into the afterlife together. It's essentially like, I assume, that fucking boat from the Lord of the Rings series. They're going off to the Asgard or whatever the fuck that place was called. They disappear from this world. It's warm. And that love is the magic that unites us all. Nick, Xerf was fucking beaten by Natsu having a savage punch of emotions.
Chris, it was because someone loved him the way that they loved Fairy Tail.
That shit is lame and preposterous.
Hey, at least Natsu's brother didn't die causing him to cry tears of blood because he cared so much.
Oh, man. At least...
That's not the part about this chapter that I dislike, actually, though.
Yeah, we'll get to that. So, cutaway, and everyone's like, is the battle over? And I also said this, I was like, is this really it? Like, this is weak shit, man. But the next panel shows fucking Makarov waking up like, I had a dream!
You see, because Xerf and Mavis went away, their influence over me disappeared, and so I'm alive now. Bitch, you sacrificed yourself!
There's no explanation to it right now. He just woke up and is like, I had a dream. It was such a strange dream. And there was life rushing through me, and I saw a barefoot girl and a boy in black flogging through a field together.
You see, Mavis and Sarah's love was so true, it had a positive influence on people entirely in relation to them. If you look over there, I'm sure that Uchiha and that one girl are going to just pop out of the portal hunky-dory.
It is baffling that he's alive. Look, it's not baffling the notion that he's alive. I never expected Nag Makarov to stay right. fully dead. I was like, he's probably gonna come back. But the why is what I don't get. Why, I don't even fully comprehend why when they just kissed and embraced, they were able to pass on. I thought the logic there being that they had to kind of, like, almost Romeo and Juliet it, like they had to kind of kill one another to pass on. But
the implication I got was that Mavis had never actually acknowledged in her heart how she actually cared about Xerath, and when she realized what she had to do, she was like, I don't want to do that, but because of that, she realized how much she loved him.
And I guess,
so as a result of that, it completed the curse. It's not the best explained thing, but it does come across.
I get the, a notion of it. The exact mechanics still kind of confuddle me. But I certainly don't understand how the act of that seems to also give this like tertiary side effect of, oh, and let's make sure Makarov comes back too. Like, was that their last act upon dying? Was fucking Xerath like, oh, hey, I have a lot of this excess life magic. What should I do with it? She's like, I guess there's a dead dude we should get, like, make alive again. Cause there's nothing.
Oh, you mean our son, August?
What? No, shut up. We don't have a kid, stupid.
I don't know what you're talking about.
There's not even anything that connects the two. It's just, let's go together, Xerath, Mavis. They have their big fucking, like, love is magic thing cut over to the battle being over, and Makarov's just alive. There's nothing that, it, like, has, like, a notion, like, the two of them as they're passing on, like, floating off above Makarov, and, like, they touch his nose or something like that, and he wakes up or something along those lines. There's nothing connecting them, which just makes me think everyone in Fairy Tail, for all of their magic, are fucking idiots who just didn't check a pulse at any point in time. They're just like, he's dead! I mean, his chest is rising and falling, but he's definitely dead!
What, does he turn to stone or some shit?
Like, it's just, like, I don't know. I don't know. And it's this weird state that I shouldn't be angry at this because I knew it was going to happen. But I'm more angry at it though, just because it immediately follows the immense disappointment of learning that's how Xerath was defeated, was by Natsu just punching him. Nothing special to it at all. Just, he's angry, and that's it. This has been so long built, and that was the conclusion to it.
Pete Pat nodded in the chat, made a point of, why would you note that Mavis was barefoot? Because Hero's a pervert.
I mean,
that was the fetish she fulfilled in addition to Loli. Like, come on. She was barefoot all the time.
Yeah.
Also, that she was naked without being naked because her clothes were illusory.
Yeah, we've got a lot to serious to talk about today. I don't want to dwell on this, but this is not a good start to the conclusion of Fairy Tail. If one of the longest running parts of Fairy Tail, one of the longest building storylines to Fairy Tail, ended with an absurdly weak conclusion to that.
I mean, you might say, like, oh, Fairy Tail was dumb, in other news, water is wet. Mm-hmm. But it is a bit different because it's a botched, important plot point, you know?
It's different than, oh, they beat Otherworld Urza really easily. Or, oh, man, I can't believe they defeated the Spriggan 12 so quickly or whatever. That's different. Those are problems built up at once.
This is closer to the issue of, we have to have Laxus have the door open for him to return, so we're all going to put our hands up in this flashback we just introduced.
It even goes one step beyond that, because it's legitimately one of the very few long-running story points in Fairy Tail. There's only been a couple. It's essentially been like Urza, Gajeel, Actalogia, and this, of Xerath. I mean, there's not too many of the things that are... Jalal, sorry. There's not been that many other long-running things that have occurred, like, throughout different arcs. I guess the Dragon Slayers as well. But this would be like if we got to the end of One Piece, and Zoro just beat Mihawk, like, without... Like, not even, like, he beat him without trying to show how strong he's gotten. He just, like, beats him with a single, like, sword slash... And you're like, oh, well, Mihawk's gonna get up and, like, have his counterattack. And Mihawk's just like, you've won my title! Goodbye! And you're just like, god damn it! We spent so long on this.
All right, with that said, let's move on to Astra, Chapter 32. There's not a whole lot of big details to really make note of. There's two major points that really occur in all of this. We get a little bit of banter at the beginning, because, you know, Kateri and Zach are kind of officially a couple now, and Kateri is being not too subtle about it, but nobody's really connecting the dots yet. But then we get our big plot point, which is that Kanata and Phoenicia are stuck out in a blizzard that has suddenly come by. Which wouldn't be too big a problem, except that there is some sort of weird plant parasite thing that has attacked Phoenicia's suit and then attacks Kanata's suits, which turns off the environmental control function of it. So they're basically just staggering through the blizzard while this is going on. We get about halfway through the chapter and Kanata manages to get them to safety, but obviously, you know, they've just gone through a blizzard together. So, they're not in very good shape.
You do have to like that there is a very overt shrinkage joke in that process as well.
Is there?
Yeah, well, as soon as Kanata's suit fails, he goes, huh? Then his face goes at, and then you can't see, like, his pelvis because he, like, kind of, zooms in. But you can see, based off of his body language, it's because he's like, oh, shit, my balls just went inside of me.
I guess you could read it that way.
What else would give him an expression exactly like that, though?
Freezing cold in general?
But the way his knees bend, come on, Dick.
Whatever. Anyway, they managed to get everyone back to the Astra about halfway through the chapter. It's actually a joke when they stagger through the door because Kanata is like, but it's this series, so, yeah. They quickly said about making sure that Kanata and particularly Phoenicia can recover. Phoenicia is put up in the infirmary and kind of has to steal What's-Her-Face's bed for a bit. Paulina, yeah, anyway. There's a little bit of conversation between Paulina and the two sisters, and you know, she talks a little bit about her relationship with the crew that she ended up leaving behind, or that rather died without her. And then Paulina says, hey, you know, you look a lot like my late mother. And you know, you're pretty, you have pale hair and skin. And so this gets Kateri talking with her about their parentage. And Paulina's like, wait, you guys aren't like biological sisters? You look so ridiculously much alike. You almost look identical. And so we get time skip and Kateri is thinking about this. She's like, you know, I've always kind of thought that because Funi basically looks like a young me, which is a thing that we made note of because it is impossible to miss that. Yes. When they have, you know, among the cast, they have the distinct hair and skin tone. But Kateri gives a little bit of backstory because she's discussing things with Kanata and Zach, saying, oh no, actually, according to what my mom said, Funi's mother actually looked a lot closer to Paulina. Funi said that she looked a lot closer to Paulina. My mom said that she was trying to be friends with her mother. And so I kind of thought that they looked similar, but apparently that's not the case. So, they get really suspicious about this and they're like, okay, well, maybe she was lying to me. And, hey, you know, maybe she ended up actually, you know, just having a second kid with someone else. And there was this whole adopted thing was in order to cover it up is essentially what they're talking about. So Zach's just like, well, we could just find out for sure. We could just run a DNA test. And Kateri's like, yeah, sure. Okay. So yeah. I mean, you know, if she's my little sister, then yeah, you know, I'll love her all the more. So we get a montage of Zach running some experiments and he has probably like his biggest emotional reaction we've seen in the series. Cause he's like,
yeah, you'd expect for like, in like normal Zach, it would be like he finds out this result and his expression would just
interesting.
Go. Like one eyebrow would quirk up. He's like, oh my God, something new just happened. But no, apparently he has a full human reaction.
He almost has like a breakdown. He's clutching his head. He's like, what the hell?
Oh, yeah. It's like a Phoenix Wright breakdown at this point. Like, he's about to just confess to the crime.
So, Zack brings Kanata over without Kitori. He says, listen, like, they're not related. They're the same person. So, clone plot! What's going on here?
Well, this is very interesting, because this is actually, I think, very good for the series, because this is a very sci-fi kind of dilemma to deal with. In this, you know, sci-fi space adventure series, most of what they've done is essentially just been a survival story in space and things like that, or a thriller story in space with a potential spy. But this is specifically the idea of, like, almost a theological kind of conflict that they're now going to have to get into. Like, hey, you've now learned that your little sister is actually a genetic clone of you. And what does that essentially entail? Like, how do you now deal with that? Like, what is your process? You know, and especially how that applies to Zack and Kitori together, because, you know, this seems to almost indicate that maybe their parents had some kind of, you know, connection to this. What does that entail with everything?
In just the last chapter, Zack talked about how his father was working on memory transfer. So it looks like their parents were somehow involved in trying to basically achieve immortality. So, yeah.
And it's, I think what may be one of the more interesting is if they tell the younger sister, whose name I'm just not remembering right now. It's something wacky and weird, and I'm not going to remember it.
Funi.
If they tell her, I mean, I forget how old she's supposed to
be.
How does she even process that? Like,
right.
There's a real interesting, moral discussion to be had here about how does one respond to this? How does one, cope with this? What are the implications outside of these two? Everything like that. But one of the big things is like, what happens when you just learn you're the clone of your big sister? And then you start to question, like, so what was my purpose? Essentially, like, was I made for some, like, there's a lot to take in. You're like, holy shit, this girl's 8. This is a tough thing for her to comprehend.
We're getting a lot of ideas thrown around the chat room, like, hey, maybe Kitori is a clone of the mother. Maybe they're both clones of her. And, you know, with all the themes that are going on with, you know, parental strain in this series, maybe more of the kids were intended to just be these puppets for their parents, with all the themes in the series about breaking away from parents and following your own path, then it would make for a very strong, dramatic thing for them to actually have that strong opposition, to have that actual danger of, not having that option presented to them.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a very significant chapter that introduces a very interesting concept into this series that I think is going to – this could potentially turn this from a series that I already enjoy into one that's incredible if this is kind of portrayed as well as I think it's going to. I mean, we've already seen this series deal with more complicated character I don't know what you even call it – character narratives than we've seen in some other kind of sort of series – that we normally talk about in this show and things like that. It's had a lot more mature themes and things like that dealt with. So if that's the angle it's going with, I'm really excited for it because I have a lot of faith in the writing for Astra, and this is a potentially amazing topic to really delve into.
And of course, you know, from all of that, hey, these kids want to go back home. Mm. Or do they?
Yeah, I mean, this would really, this would really start to kind of put more things into context too, yeah.
So there you go. And hey, you know, that there's so many different ways you can interpret all this information because, hey, you know, if there's supposed to be a traitor among them, maybe they're actually trying to protect the kids by preventing them from being taken back to be used this way. So
I forget what the traitor did, though. Didn't they sabotage something else?
There was sabotage, and also the thing that they're related to how they got stuck out in space to begin with.
Okay. So I was trying to think there's anything life-threatening, but I guess it potentially could be that they're someone trying to just keep them away from their parents. Which would make sense. As we said, we're on, what, planet 4 or 4 in their supposed to trip return? If they're going to, you know, turn back or go somewhere else or just stay where they are, this would be the place to make that opinion on.
And then, of course, you know, it's not going to be a matter of once we get back, the journey is done, then there would be an entire new problem to take care of.
Annalise also just threw out in the chat that there's a suggestion out there that all the kids died in space, and these are clones of them. I mean, who knows? There's a lot. I mean, when you put in cloning and things like that, there's a lot to start handling. But, Ares mentions if Kanata hadn't reminded me, I wouldn't have put my helmet on.
All right. Oh, no, it's a video game.
It's all you need is kill. They just like, they keep going over it. One dude has the memories.
Anyway, oh, I feel really, really upset now. Let's talk about Food Wars, because, oh, God, nothing will make my head hurt as much as this, at least. So, Food Wars, Shokugeki no Soma 216, Shouldering Polaris, with a pretty badass color opening page with Ishiki and Soma hold katanas. I like how Ishiki looks like he knows what he's doing and Soma doesn't.
Yeah. Soma's like, I can chop the sword! I can chop carrots with this, right?
Well, there goes my finger.
And so that'll be the main ingredient of my gumbo surprise.
It's finger food.
Oh, man.
So we get a flashback to where Ishiki kind of was observing all of his dorm mates as they were working on various different recipes. Ideas. And, so, Ishiki's looking over them, kind of like, none of you will ever get to do anything important, so I shall be the one that you vicariously live through. Hey, Basaki, remember when you looked like you were gonna get to be important? Nope.
Shit.
You carry that log and chainsaw around like you're important. Go ahead. So, inspired by all that, he presents his dish, which he calls Hitsumabushi Polaris style. Explanation of the dish. It's all fancy looking. You can tell because it's on a giant oversized plate. Therefore, it is gourmet food.
Yeah, it's a huge plate with very little actual food on it. That means it's very well-made food.
The way that the restaurants actually make money is that they charge you to rent plate space.
And they give you actual very little retail or realty on it.
Okay, but if I'm being charged for the plate, then, you know, like, this only fits in, like, a fifth of it. Okay, hang on, let me pour sauce over the rest of it, and...
Yeah, I'm gonna drizzle the cost. Now the whole plate's being used. I'm like, got me there.
No, you better... No, stick with the hits. That'll impress the critic. It works! I watched that movie a couple of weeks ago.
Which one was this?
Chef.
Oh, yes.
With
John Favreau.
That was it. I was trying to find his name.
Now I really want a Cuban sandwich. God damn it, Nick.
Cubans are great. Anyhow.
I had tangent. I know we're not supposed to do tangents. Tangent. When I was in Spain, the first dish I had there, we had just gotten into Madrid and we were really hungry to grab something to eat. So we just went to like a quick diner or something like that. And I was like, fresh off the plane, I was trying to use my Spanish, but I couldn't. I was like, I don't really want to like try to figure this out. I'm still at this point now where I'm like, in Spain, do they have waiters to come to my table? Am I supposed to order at the bar up? I'm so confused. So I just ordered the first thing I saw, and I saw a Cuban sandwich. I was like, let's try it. This was not only the best Cuban sandwich I ever had, it was the best sandwich I ever had, because it was a regular Cuban, but then it also just had Eggs Benedict basically included in the top. Like, they cut a hole in the top of the toast, put a fucking fried egg inside of that, put some, like, cheese
and shit.
I was like, this is amazing. I didn't ask. I this is more than I bargained for, but this is so good.
All right.
Props to Spain and their Cuban sandwiches.
Yeah. Spanish Cuban. Got it. So, the people in Polaris who are in the cage are like, wait, you used stuff that we made in your dish? And Ishiki's like, yes, I stole it all with my two hands. Continuing his very bizarre choices on where to put in his cool one-liners or cool poses. So, yeah. people try the dish, and they're like, oh, hot rice melted into cheese. Blah, da, 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 da. Oh, it's amazing! Fan service shots! It's like an eel is tangling around me, and probably the most, like, honestly, like, regular bit of fan service that we've had from the series in a while.
Yeah, this was definitely one of those ones that was a bit more to the point of like, oh, I guess, yeah, you just gotta do it from time. Like, and we may mention, like, last week, I think it was, that you're like, oh, yeah, or the one with, Kinokuni, where like, yeah, you just gotta, right. You're just gonna have to expect every girl in the series eventually is going to get naked at some point, just, you know, it's kind of what's gonna happen. But then there's this one, and I was like, cause it's not like a full page spread kind of thing, it's just like, oh, then no. There are sometimes where you're like, oh, yeah, it's just a little weird.
Just can't read this in public, okay.
Yeah, I'm glad
she's wearing clothes. At least she's wearing a swimsuit in this shot.
I will tell you this. It is very nice now to be at the point where when this series comes out, I'm usually at home and I can read this in the privacy of my home, as opposed to when I used to read it on my break at lunch or at work and I had to worry about people passing by, particularly for fucking usually food wars. It was almost always food wars was what would really get me in trouble. If I saw something going by, I'm like, oh god, they're gonna think I'm watching weird Japanese eel porn. And they're gonna think that's a thing, and I'm gonna have to explain how it's not, but it's not too far from some real things over there, and then I have to get into that, oh, it's gonna be problems.
But you are right that it is kind of under-emphasized, because they gotta save that for the real money shot of the chapter. So, we get an explanation. What is the special thing of the dish? It's garlic. Special smoked garlic chips that Iwasaki made. And he crushed them, sprinkled them on as a topping, make a nice little crunchy texture. And he gives this big speech. And he's like, what makes them so extraordinary is that they're infused with Iwasaki's earnest passion. So of course they're delicious. Blah, blah, blah. And so he then addresses Julio and he offers him a plate. And he's like, I will have you apologize to the students of Polaris for how you insulted them before. And Julio's like, no, garlic in a traditional Japanese dish. I'm not going to eat that shit. Screw you. And Ishiki's like, well, I don't follow traditional Japanese cooking. What I make is Ishiki cooking. Because he's a weirdo like that.
Okay. So, like, so you do have a specialty? He's like, eh. My specialty is everything.
Erina gets a bit of an internal monologue. Saying, I recall reading the report on a particular shokugeki in which he participated. In it, one of the judges described his cooking thusly, the ultimate and aggressive Japanese cuisine, which isn't too great until you get the shot of him surrounded by fucking dragons.
Yeah, you know what? I didn't realize it beforehand, but I'm like, oh, okay, so he would be essentially, I still can't figure out my term for this kind of character. But if this helps, I've now realized Ishiki is kind of like the Jin of this series, where it's like on the side, or you're just like, he's the older dragon lord master. I can't think of the term I want to use to describe this character, but that the moment of seeing him surrounded by dragons with a katana, yeah. I'm just like, okay, I get it.
Right. The badass upperclassman supporting character.
Yeah.
And a lot of the anime have that kind of thing. It's a very big, like, what was it? GX does that with Marufuji, so. So, Julio is like, well, if there's dragons staring me down, I guess I gotta eat it. I think is his decision-making process. So he digs in, and he's like, oh, it's so supremely delicious. Oh, it's such amazing, fragrant eel. Oh, I can't resist against this. It's so wonderful. And Ishiki's like staring at him and waiting for him to apologize. And he's like, oh, mi scusi! And Jesus Christ.
Here's what I do love, though, about Food Wars. It will be as shameless as possible, but it will be equal opportunity in that at least at certain points, if you are somebody who admires the male physical form, you will get your shots of cheesecake dudes as well.
Well, that's not even a cheesecake, dude. Look at that guy. Look at that awful fucking face.
Look, Nick, somewhere out there, there are people who are like, I love dudes, but only butt-face chin dudes. That's my thing. That's my kink. I want that. They're getting theirs, all right? Maybe that's, like, the lully, like, equivalent for dudes. Like, they're, like, like how, like, there's a lully, like, subgenre for, like, a female character. Like, if it was, like, a reverse harem, they're like, well, you gotta have the butt chin guy. Like, you just gotta have one of those. It's like, you gotta have your smart guy, your rebel.
You're gonna have your male harem.
Nick, it's
you gotta
like
have
a...
your sports. You gotta have your jock, your bad boy, your nerd, your shota, and then your ugly dude.
it's like your classic boy band tropes. You gotta have the ugly one, the boy band, the bad boy, your pretty boy, your butt shin dude.
Oh god. All right, so that's the end of the chapter. Ishiki fucking trounces Julio. Which, just leaves one more of the first round matches to go. And we, haven't seen a single peek of, what's going on in that match yet. So I guess we'll get a bit for in the next chapter.
No, yeah, I don't know how I'm feeling at that point because as you mentioned, it's, we at this point, haven't seen that thing at all.
In the slightest.
Yeah, like they alluded.
We still don't really know the gender of the person that Megashima is taking on.
We don't even know if they're cooking. We don't know anything. Like, they haven't even cut to them for like reactions to things that are happening.
They're just playing jacks in the corner.
Like, I think maybe once we may have cut over to Megashima doing like having like reacting to the fact that the other fight is done or something like that, but other than that, like,
which is a little hard because he looks a bit like Subaru with his current attire. So
yeah, so I'm at this point where I'm like, I mean, I guess they could just immediately address it next time and just be like, okay, he started his match, he's kind of won. It feels weird though because even though he was obviously a jobber, like we still got a chapter ahead of time to know who fucking Julio was before he lost. So it is like one of those things. I'm like, are we gonna get anything? What's happening?
But anyway, we're gonna talk about some Dr. Stone now. Last time, in order to gain revenge on Tsukasa, who definitely killed Senku, Yuzuriha and Taiju managed to explode gunpowder in his face, which definitely killed him. I find out in this chapter that they're both alive, but we kind of figured that.
Well, to be fair, we haven't fully, we get the impression Senku is alive. We don't know if he's alive to continue the series because this is a very interesting chapter of Dr. Stone. As we turn back the pendulum, Nick.
I'm just gonna start getting Z equals negative one.
I'm like, dude, you're on chapter 12, you can't do this. You don't tell me what I can't do. Don't tell me what I can't do!
I don't like using double digits, Mr. He's gonna start going off on the Z graphic. So, we see that Tsukasa's fine. He establishes he's fine by blowing away all of the powder by whipping his cloak off so he's bare-chested now. And he's like, behold my nippleless form.
Ah.
So, what he essentially establishes that he did was he split the blast in two to create an escape route, which I don't know how the fuck that works.
I guess,
what it says is that he actually shattered the jar of black powder on purpose, and in order to spread it out in a certain way. So he kind of spread it out horizontally and then moved perpendicular to that. So that instead of it all blowing up in his face, it more just created a smoke screen, which still helped out Taiju and Yuzuriha to escape.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of figuring out what, it was kind of like figuring things out as they happened. And, we don't really see him after this point, but he's like, you know, it's fine though. You know, I killed Senku. I snapped his cervical plexus in this stone world without modern medical care. Any attempt to bring him back will be futile. So Taiju and Yuzuriha get off to a safe distance, and Taiju starts doing some bizarrely, weirdly placed comic relief, because he's like, okay, yeah, heart massage, shit, this isn't working, mouth to mouth, and he's like freaking puckering up and his eyes are getting
up. Yeah, you get like Sojo eyes all of a sudden.
Yuzuri has like, his neck, though. You know?
Stop moving it so wildly.
So Taiju is like, Senku sacrificed himself. And we get a flashback to when a psychology teacher who was apparently presenting from magic psychology by Gin Asagiri, which is seemingly a manga.
Yeah, it definitely looks like a manga.
Like, is that supposed to be a teacher, or is he just a random student? They're chilling out in a science class. I can't really tell.
I think the implication is supposed to be that he's the teacher, because Senku is giving him, like, a response as though it's, like, an answer to a test or something like that. So I do believe the implication is that they're being taught a lesson, and Senku's like, fuck you, I beat the Kobayashi Maru.
And Yuzuri has, you know, basically they're like, okay, here's the situation. You can only save yourself, your friend, or your significant other after there's been a terrible accident. So what do you choose? So we get a little bit of insights on Yuzuri, because she's like, oh, I would have a hard time picking between my friend or my boyfriend. And then, like, the little glasses douchebag is like, oh, you would pick yourself in the moment, though, right? It's like, fuck you! You don't know her!
Well, to be fair, the notion is in there of, yeah, you would say in this moment, I don't get enough of this dude to know whether or not he's doing it because he's an asshole or if he's just trying to ask the real question of like, yeah, I mean, I know we all say that, but in the moment, you'd probably pick yourself, right? But then again, it is still that thing of like, what the fuck? You don't know. You don't know me.
Exactly.
Don't bro me if you don't know me.
That's something that you can only really say to someone if they're like a close friend. Like, you know, if you say like, if you were to ask me, Nick, if you had to choose between saving Chris or yourself or your girlfriend, but oh, I'd save my girlfriend. Like, oh yeah, but what if it actually happened though? You turn tail and run. If this random stranger did that, you know, whatever. If you did it to bust my balls or whatever, or I would actually listen to you if you had a real point to make. But what? We've never seen this guy before. You're right.
You wouldn't save me, Nick. It's fucking What's harsh. That? You wouldn't save
I'm sorry.
Me. Fuck
I'm
you.
Sorry. So, I'm sorry, priorities.
There is a long-standing credo that is very derogatory, but still stands the test, that it's supposed to be about friendship.
If you were between...
You know what, Nick? I don't care. There's out there were nipples on Tsukasa. You just missed them.
If it were between you and me, I might have a different response, but anyway. So... we've never seen this guy before, so yeah, you make a good point, like, we don't really know exactly what his standing with these people is, so he does kind of come off like a little douchebag.
Yeah.
But anyway, the whole point of this is that Senku says, I would find a way to save everyone. So yeah, he flat out kirks it, and says like, no, I would find a way to save everyone, it doesn't matter. So, then Taiju's like, oh, if that's an option, I'm going to pick that one, too. And Yuzuri is like, yeah, I didn't know that was a choice. And the guy's like, no, see, you have to talk about who the most important person is. And Senku's like, no, what kind of garbage did you find that book in?
It is worth noting that he doesn't truly kirk it, because he isn't actually yet posed with the stare. He just says, I'd figured it out. But I suppose in practice he is... Because it does seem like all three of them made it out of the situation. However, I don't know if the rules are the same, because it wasn't technically you had to save yourself or this one person or this one person. I guess we'll never
know. The guy flat says, imagine that there's been a terrible accident, you can only save yourself, your friend, or your significant other. Which of them do you choose? It's that whole kind of thing, like, you know.
If you're on a boat and your dad and mom are drowning, which one do you save? And I'm just like, well. I don't know.
Or like, you know, the house. There was actually a funny thing in a Discworld book once, which this guy who had been described as being kind of simple through the book was asked the question of, let's say your house is on fire and you only have time to take out one thing in the entire house. What do you choose?
The house.
And so afterwards, someone...
The fire.
Exactly.
Magic.
So someone asks him, someone says, oh, I bet that you, you know, would choose to take your mother outside in order to save her. And he was like, no. I'd take out the fire. It's like, ah.
Look at you, crafty motherfucker.
So, So then, from that point on, all philosophical questions had to have incredible specificities put into the question being posed. Anyway, so Taiju concludes from this, okay, Senku wouldn't commit suicide even if it was to save us. He would find a way. He would always find a way. And Yuzurika comes to a realization, which is that Senku, of course, was being very specific about pointing out his neck. He didn't actually offer the suggestion, but he was, you know, like, motioning towards it. And she was like, yeah, she was drawing Tsukasa's attention there. And Taiju realizes, hey, this entire time that we've been here, Senku's been, like, cracking his neck a whole lot. And that's not something he did before. That's not a normal nervous tic of his. So he checks around the back of Senku's head and finds that, just like Yuzuriha had a little bit of stone left on her foot, Senku's got a bit right on the back of his head at the base of his neck. And so they whip out the revival fluid and pour it on the crack, which starts to break. And, you know, Taiju, of course, is desperately begging, oh, come on, Senku, wake up. I know you can make it. Come back to us. Open your eyes, Senku. We get the chapter title, which is Epilogue of Prologue, End of Part Zero.
Yeah, you know, this is interesting. I immediately kind of, I don't know why, like, I guess it's just that rule of cool thing that kind of shown in these sort of series that, like, fundamentally, it doesn't make this any better, but I'm just like, oh, a prologue? Holy crap. Let's see what that, like, what does this mean? Everything we've read to this point has been a prologue? Like, are we gonna time skip then? Like, what's the separating factor? Like, it's immediately interesting, but I do have a lot of, obviously, respect for the series and Inagaki, who's writing it. I'm very interested to see where this goes. It's just the six where you finish reading, you're like, wait a minute, this was part zero? What does that even mean? Is Senku dead? Because he didn't wake up at the end of the chapter. We are seeing him having thoughts, but what does that mean? It's like, I don't know.
Anyway, we're 12 chapters into the story now, so next time we'll start part one of the story. Which does, yeah, look like it's going to be a bit of a flashback. Because this story actually starts with Senku's awakening, so let's turn the clock back. So,
yeah, so that's definitely going to be a very interesting development, because to what we've known thus far, Senku was the only one who was up at that time. Like, is this going to be a story told entirely of Senku being the only character, or are we about to learn that Senku didn't tell us everything, you know? Like, what's going to happen?
So, interesting chapter, and, yeah. I mean, it didn't exactly take a twist that we weren't expecting, but it was still a little bit of a cool way of going about it, I think.
Yes.
So.
Alright, so, we got two chapters of We Never Learned, which I think finally have us completely caught up to where the series should be.
I think so, because this takes us to chapter 14. So,
and I believe that's where it was in it. There may actually be one more, because I feel like it was three chapters ahead of Dr. Stone, but I may be mistaken
on that.
You might
be right.
So there may be one more of that, but we're just about current. There's two chapters here. You think, oh no, this episode's already short on time. How could they get through them all? These are really quick chapters to explain, because in the first one, it's all about Uruka, Takamoto.
Uruka.
Why do I try to say the hard part of her name? Takamoto. Going to school, find out it's sports festival day, and oh no, she realized she has forgotten her bra.
She was on a rush to get out of the house, and so she forgot about it.
Yes.
So she's got to do rigorous activity while her boobs are flopping around everywhere.
And
oh no!
Here's the thing. I imagine this is a very legitimate problem. I'm not a woman. I've never worn a bra. I don't know how that, like, exactly works, but I imagine it is a very legitimate thing. It's obviously being used in this series because it gives Takamoto, like, the ability to be very embarrassed and nervous and worried about her breasts moving around. So it's not necessarily explicitly done for the sexual fan servicey kind of nature, but it is a vehicle to that point, which is always, like, a little bit kind of weird, because it's a long chapter, basically, of her worried about her breasts bouncing around too much. Or her breasts rubbing against someone, which is just kind of strange. And there is one point, for the most part, it's a very innocent chapter of, you know, considering what the topic was. And there is a joke at the end where she realizes, oh, I could have just worn my swimsuit the entire time and solved that problem, which is like, yeah, I thought you were always wearing your swimsuit underneath.
That seems to be a recurring thing with her because, you know, considering like, you know, when she accidentally gave Yuiga the swimsuits at one point and then, you know, she realizes things afterwards. She's like, oh my God, I'm such an idiot.
Yeah. So I
think. Which is endearing, honestly, but.
Yeah. But there is one point wherein she kind of, has been messing up because she's been too nervous because her brain's not in the right place. She's too busy focusing on this nervous feeling she has. She thinks everyone's staring at her and noticing it, although no one's saying anything. She tries to basically like dunk on Yuiga and she tries to get past him and she can't. And Yuiga kind of gives her a pep talk and he's just like, hey, like, is everything okay? Cause you're not the wonderfully talented, bright star you are when you're normally playing sports. And of course she has a moment where she like just brain translates that to I love you, which I found kind of funny. So she gets serious. She's like, I don't care. I'm going to do this. So she goes up to try to like dunk on him, but like misses in air and lands on him essentially to the point where her breasts are directly on top of him. And she's like, oh, I hope he didn't notice. And he does. And Yuiga says the weirdest thing. He says, my sister goes around the house like that too, so no big deal, you know? And I was like, what, ew.
Why do you know that?
Dude, why would you think that's... Because here's the thing, I've noted before, Yuiga, like, what I've enjoyed about him is he's not really pervy. Like, it seems like every time it happens, he seems legitimately kind of shy by and things like that. And I get he's supposed to be kind of like a nerd, but I've never gotten the idea he's, like, socially stupid. But this is, like, a weird... This is like me saying, I'm sorry my dad never taught me how to play catch in response to what happened. It's just like, wait, why is that the immediate connection you'd say and why would you say it? And that's the chapter, actually. Like, after that, it's in beach.
And again, about your sister.
Yeah.
A little bit of a call break.
Sorry. But yeah, and then after that, Takamoto is just like, I could have worn my swimsuit. That's the first chapter. Second chapter is one focused more on Ogata. And there's a little bit at the start where I guess they're going on like a field trip. And
right. A study trip.
A study trip. And Yuiga is actually trying to pick some, I guess they're just plants and not flowers at all. And the teacher's like, come on, let's like, don't dawdle off to the side or something like that. And, you know, he's like, oh, but I really want them for my sister. And
you
Ogata,
can use this to make tempura. Yeah.
Yeah. Ogata kind of takes notice of that. We kind of bounce around to a couple different places then. It's mostly just a chapter focusing on the fact that Ogata kind of is getting more aware that there's feelings going on here. Like Fumino specifically noted during that trip. She's like, what's going on? You've been looking at him a whole lot. And now she's like, thinking,
I do like her reaction to this because she's like, who has? You!
she does have, I don't know if it, maybe I just didn't notice it before, but she does have very robotic reactions now. She's like, why would Fumino say a thing like that? Why would I watch Yuiga more than what is absolutely necessary? No, it's just my imagination. Oh,
she's very robotic in this chapter. She starts reciting probabilities of likely scenarios, and it's like, when did she start doing this?
So just like, oh, hey, his eraser's getting small. I should give him mine. But wait a minute. Perhaps if I do that, that'll up the probability that Fumino thinks that I'm giving him more attention than he deserves. Like, it's a bunch of weird stuff like that. But the ultimate point is that Ogata is starting to realize maybe there's something there, and she has to start kind of addressing this. It eventually just leads to her kind of running away because she can't deal with those feelings, and she's off in the woods playing.
I do like the little exchange that leads up to it.
Okay.
Because what's happening is she's trying to get something out of the vending machine, but she can't reach the button for it. And I just like that because she's established to be, you know, like, the Thumbelina or whatever, but they never actually do anything with the fact that she's actually really short before this. So it's nice that they use that detail to have this thing play out where Yuga helps her to get it, and she's like, why'd you do that? I don't understand. I'm not looking at you.
Probability incorrect. Error.
delete.
But she runs off into the woods where she starts playing what I guess is that card game she was a couple weeks ago. We got some comments of people mentioning that it is a card game in Japan. I guess we just don't really, it doesn't have like a equivalent over here. And while she's doing it, she notices, oh, hey, there are some of those plants that, Yuega wanted to pick up before. And, oh, here there's more and more. And she kind of keeps going until she gets lost out in the woods. Yuega then realizes, like, oh, hey, it's raining outside. That's looking really bad. And that's when, I forgot what her name is. Oh, Sakijo. Sorry. Sakijo shows up and says, hey, where's Ogata? And, something interesting does happen, Nick. So, Sakijo kind of notes, like, Ogata isn't anywhere. She's not in the study hall or the lecture, and she didn't bring her cell phone. And Yuega says, you really do like Ogata, don't you? And she's like, what? Do not be absurd! And she's blushing, because she has feelings for him.
Okay.
You're good, Obi. Free pizza.
Okay. I had, like, 12 people messaging me on Twitter, say, like, Nick, you have no gaydar and equivalent stuff like that. So, it seems as though you have the people on your side in this.
I'm the people's podcaster, Nick. New title.
Now, let me tell you something right here. This podcasting business. it's much easier for me to do a Triple H than a Rock, so whatever. I think that we're going to actually have to, like, establish rules on this. Like, we're going to have to, like, establish, like, where on the scale of Soifons we're going to have this lesbian crush actually have to land for it to be. Because we get something a lot fucking gayer in Black Clover, I'll tell you that.
I would say, you know, maybe we can hash off the details. We also, I think, need to decide on a topping limit as well. That's something we'll have to kind of get it into. But, I would say we haven't proven anything yet. Nothing's been verified, but I would say we certainly are in a state of flux where, it seems to be moving in one direction, but nothing definitive yet.
Definitely not yet. I think that it's going to land somewhere between where you were predicting and where I was predicting when we talked about this last time. So, but we're going to have to establish before it gets too far where the line's going to be and when that's going to then be surpassed. Because this is a legitimate bet that we're doing. So it should have actual rules to it that should not be defined subjectively.
I take pizza bets very seriously too, Nick.
It's very important. And also I have been kind of been on the lookout because since we're making, this is one where only I can, like, reward you the pizza. I'm going to have to find something that we've adamantly disagree on that I can make bet with you on.
All right. Anyway. So that basically just leads to Yuega learning that Ogata's still out there in the woods, out in the rain. So he goes out searching for her, and he finds her basically up on this rock above him. And, you know, the entire time that she's there alone, she's thinking about, like, oh, I don't have my phone. I don't know where I am. All I can do is stay put and wait for someone to find me. And, you know, there's a 96% chance that a teacher will find me. And instead, she keeps finding herself thinking that Yuega will be the one to show up and find her. And she's like, error, that's incorrect. It's foolish to add such a small probability to my mind as though that would be the likely result. And I was rude to him anyway. Like, she keeps going down the percentages because she's like, oh, and I was rude to him and et cetera, et cetera. And that's when Riega shows up. And I mentioned she's up kind of above and she's sitting, like, you know, with her knees up against her, like her knees are up against her chest, but I guess not
completely. I get this in the panel because I'm, seems like,
yeah, like she's sitting on the ground. And of course it's like schoolgirl. So she has a skirt and she has her legs like bent, but not completely closed.
She's sitting comfortably.
Yeah. And Yuega shows up and his gaze is turned to the side, but his first response is, you shouldn't sit like that. It's kind of revealing, Ogata. And I was just like, dude, again, what the fuck happened? Like, you have no tact. This is so weird. There wasn't any better way to say, like, couldn't you have just had your gaze turned elsewhere and said, like, oh, hey, Ogata, how are you? Like, I found you, and have, maybe she would realize it, or, like, I feel like there's ways you could have put that thought out there without having to bluntly say, like, You shouldn't sit like that. That's awfully revealing. Like, fuck you. You're not her fucking mom, first or foremost. You're not her charm school teacher.
Yeah. Stop robot spreading, Ogata.
But yeah, Ogata's just like, oh, how'd you find me? And, you know, Yuega's eventually mentioned that it was, he followed her based off of the card game that they found. He found one of the cards she was playing, used it to find him. And then Note's like, oh, you had all those plants I was trying to collect earlier. And she's like, yes, I collected them. And he's really glad she's okay. She goes to fall, or I guess fidget down the, like, small cliff or whatever.
Right.
And slips. And then falls directly on top of him. And this, I guess, is meant to be very significant because it's basically a 2-page spread of her falling into him. And though we don't get enough of a close-up on the actual lips, it seems to suggest that they may have fallen into a kiss, more or less.
It definitely, it is pretty much almost certainly an accidental kiss moment.
Yeah.
So
I suppose in that way is meant to be a very significant chapter because it's all about Ogata kind of coming to terms with the fact that she may have feelings for him, and then something accidental may push more of a realization to it to be dealt with.
Yeah, and this is also going to be one of the first chapters that we've gotten in a while that actually seems to have, like, you know, consequences.
That may continue into next week, too.
Right, because we've been getting a lot of one-off chapters lately, and this one looks like it might actually fucking continue into the next one. Or, as Lost Thief points out, and that's how Yuga broke his fucking teeth and goes into debt paying for the surgery. That's where this is all going.
Man, love, that'd be sad.
Love plot dropped. You never find out if Seikijo actually has lesbian crush on Ogata. Just
our pizza bed is ruined!
No! got kind of up and down, honestly, with these two chapters. There are moments that I like and dislike in both. I don't know. Feel very ambivalent on them overall. I kind of like the second one a little bit more than the first, though.
I definitely like the second one more, just because the first one's a little bit weird with the topic at hand, and again, it has very tactless Yuega moment, but at least the second one seems to be progressing things a little bit forward.
And it's an actual, like, important thing that's going on, as opposed to, I forgot my bra!
Yeah. Which I know we said I have no context for, but let's be real, Nick. We've all had that kind of day, right?
So we're going to do The Promised Everland, Chapter 40, The Snakes of Alva... Okay, no one can blame me for this. Alvapanera.
Stupid old Nick doesn't know how to pronounce Alvapanera. I fucked that up even in my attempt to try to mock you.
Hey, I think you actually did a better job than I did, though.
Oh, wait.
Demons.
Hold on. Is that... Oh, okay, no, that's a blank space in the book. For a moment, I was like, wait a minute. Is that an apostrophe between the OF and the rest? And I was like, oh, no, that's just blank space in the book. That, for a brief moment, I thought was an apostrophe. I was like, wait a minute, Nick. I think it's awful alpinaria.
Demons are looking for the kids. Pretty imposing looking. It looks like there are different types of demons because there are larger kind of hound-like ones in addition to a smaller, more humanoid one looking for them. So, we get a bit of a explanation for what Emma was onto in the last chapter, which, is that, this situation that they're in with the trees vines going after them is very similar to one of William Minerva's books. One of two special books by Mr. Minerva. The one with the Morse code for promise. It's called The Adventures of Ugo. The hero of the story is Ugo, and with his partner Marvine the Lemur, they travel the unexplored regions of the world. It's an adventure novel. And so this is very reminiscent of The Snakes of Alvapanera. Basically, within the story, the hero lands in a cave. There are snakes that reach towards him, and so Emma thinks this situation is actually kind of similar. It's about the tree as opposed to an actual group of snakes. And so she says, this adventure novel is a manual for surviving in the outside world. Ray's like, well, there might be similarities, but... Okay, actually, you might be right. So
I normally I don't plug too much during the show, try to keep that towards the end, but I do need to know, guys, if you enjoy the baby memories ray that we've created, you definitely need to check out the most recent bonus pod we put up with a weekly manga recap lives that includes
we went kind of nuts with it. Yeah.
it was one of those moments where after I'm done, I'm just like, oh, I love doing these things. It's legitimately like one of those times where I'm like, that was some of the most fun I've had in a while, kind of.
Also, if you check that out, you can find out what voice I chose to do for Uruka. It's, yeah. It's fun too.
And you'll find out how I broke my CPAP machine.
So they test it out. They're like, okay, so according to what we are learning from this, then the vines should only be reacting to touch. They can't actually see us or anything like that, or hear us. So Ray tosses a cup, and when it touches the vines, they immediately coalesce around it and crush it. So they're like, aha! Alright, so by contact. It's not by heat, sound, or the vibration of the ground. When the prey touches the tip of the root, the tree learns the location and attacks, and the way the roots move. So, I'm like, alright, so we should actually be able to get out of here. And they basically just follow the directions, the example set by the Avenger Novel. They demonstrate to all the kids that they can get right up next to the vines and they still won't actually be touched or attacked by them. And after they do that, they're like, okay, we can get past these, we can climb up here. And from there, according to this, we need to collapse the ceiling of the cave. And so they work together to grab onto a bunch of the ceiling vines, rip them down, and a bunch of cold air from outside comes bursting in, which is deadly to the vines as it touches them. And it immediately cools down the area that they're in right away. And so, basically, Emma spots something behind them at the very end of the chapter, but that's it.
I will note that there's a couple things I really like about this chapter. One, I really like that moment where Ray starts to realize what's happening and he does start to kind of like calculate the ways to get through it. But when the moment comes and everyone's starting to get really nervous, the first thing that like Emma and what I like is that Ray also joins in with this is that they both have this moment where they basically reassure the kids of being like, look, everything's okay. And we kind of already saw that this was a change that Ray was making when he had that moment where he grabbed the one girl who was afraid to go like a hang gliding or whatever, zip line across, and he kind of showed he had like an ability to be empathetic. And I do like that we can still see it here, because I know we make jokes about Ray being the douchey hipster with the baby memories, but it is nice to see that his edge is being softened and has been softened, and he does seem to be making some active changes. But the other thing I really like is that I mentioned previously this could be interesting because what the Promised Neverland had built itself up onto until this point had been psychological battles. How do we escape? Let's think of what Mom would do. This mental chess match, essentially. And now they were dealing with something physical, a physical threat. And what I liked is that this chapter had them address it in much the same way we've kind of seen it. They were very calculating everything there. There wasn't any like, all right, you know, let's drop fire on this thing and see if we can escape it before the flames. Like, it was all just logical thinking of how can we essentially, I guess, trick this plant into escaping from it in a way, more or less. Like, this isn't something they like, oh, quickly, let's put together a shotgun and blast away this plant or something like that. This still was a situation where it was wits and thinking that got them out of this. And that is, exciting notion for me, because I hope that is still kind of the element of the series that is strongest going forward, more or less. I there's always a part of me when it's a Jump series that worries, even if something's successful, it may just eventually transition into a battle manga, because that doesn't always work out, cough cough Madoka box. But I do like that this series seems to be sticking to what it's good at right now. And I'm not saying it would be good as a battle manga, but I like that we're sticking to the mental challenges.
Another thing that I like is that, you know, we're getting more and more of this as they go along, that now Emma and Ray have to be the leaders of this group of kids. Before, they were essentially a very small group that was working together. And they, you know, took precedence over Dawn and Gilda, but they were all just like a group of kids. They were all in it together. And now they're having to lead around this group of much less mature and intelligent kids. And so they really have to kind of take them by the hand and convince them that they need to work together in order to get out of this situation. And that's a full to what they have to do.
If I were to say one thing, though, and this is something I legitimately hope we do get going forward, I do feel like we need to start building the personality and characters of these other kids as well. Because even Don and Gilda have been kind of not all that significant. I know they mentioned that they were doing a whole lot while Emma and Ray had to basically pretend to be despondent. But we see these kids and we know like some of their names, but we don't have many character traits for them. You know, there's not a lot that I could say if you said, like, oh, explain Chris to me, you know, because one of the kids is Chris. I couldn't tell you anything about him, you know? So for a series that has a very limited character pool to our knowledge right now, you know, it's something that if these kids are going to be around in a significant way, I do hope we get a little bit of detail for them. Doesn't have to happen right now, but I hope that is something we do get.
We know that Don is, like, their action guy. And Gilda is...
Is he? I always thought he was just supposed to be the dope. Like, he was the smart guy, but just really dopey.
Well, his reaction in the last chapter was like, hey, I can climb up this set of vines. And, you know, during the escape, he was the one who...
Sorry. I just like when B. Patton on, I said in the chat, Chris is awkward because his dad never played catch with him.
He forced it out of weird times.
Good callback.
Good boy. But yeah, to your point, yeah, we know more about Phil than a lot of these since he's not around, so.
Yeah.
Okay, but with that done, we are going to move on to the Seven Deadly Sins.
Yes, Seven Deadly Sins, Chapter 219, The Heroes Take a Break. And again, because we're going to be kind of packed with time this week, we won't be touching on 219.5 or whatever. Maybe next time, but...
No, we won't go through that very essential shopping for panties chapter, sorry.
But this is the chapter of the heroes relaxing and kind of taking a break after some very significant and emotional chapters the past few weeks. And it starts with the reveal of a new Boar Hat bar. And that's kind of like the start of it, is just kind of reacting to it. And
Hawk's back, Chris.
Yes, Hawk's back. Well, you look, I left him for you, Nick. You're the one who loves Hawk.
Hawk's back.
Chris, Hawk's back.
It's not his best chapter, honestly.
There's a different couple jokes there about like how there's a new room for Bon and Melodious, like them basically trying to do like a coin flip, I guess, to see who will get it. More or less, yeah. like Bond walks into the room and the lady's like, well, flip a coin for it. We also see, I forget what her name, the king's sister. I'm blanking right on her name. Elena, I think it is. Something like that.
Elaine.
Yeah, Elaine. The other girls try to basically sneak up on her, but she has, you know, she can read their minds.
I can hear your heart. Yeah, shit.
So she's just like, you know, it's not going to work. But you know, they're coming to comfort her and, you know, have fun, and they also start talking essentially about where Diane's been recently, and she mentions like, oh yeah, I went to the past, and the kind of thing that I guess to note from it is she mentions to Elizabeth, oh hey, we met the captain from the past and a carbon copy of you, Elizabeth. And I'm forgetting, Elizabeth doesn't have any real context yet for that, does she? She doesn't really note anything about that. So this might be a pretty significant thing for her to realize why Melodious has those feelings for her the way he does. We don't have time to dwell on that, though, because we cut away to King drinking with Gowther. And I guess we're coming in a really long time into this, because King's shit-faced.
He is smashed.
He is blottoed right now. And he's just like, not drinking. Like, he's all fat and everything. Like, he's lost the ability, I guess, to even control that magic. And he's angry because Gowther's not drinking at all. And Gowther just explains, he's like, for the 12th time, I am a doll, so I cannot drink alcohol. And they're just... I guess King kind of put this out there because he wanted to, I guess, get them both drunk so that they could have, like, bro talk with them, more or less.
Which is a very bizarre thing for King to decide, honestly.
Well, what's weird is, like, he went into it with that notion, I guess. And, like, 12 cups in or whatever, he's just like, why aren't you drinking? I'd be like, after, like, 3, wouldn't you realize this plan's not working out in your favor the way you think? Like, maybe this is the first cup and King's just a fucking lightweight, but...
Well, Gowther has told him 12 times now, so...
Yeah. But anyway, he was basically, as Gowther even kind of correctly points out, was intending to rely on Liquid Courage to kind of have a heart-to-heart and essentially say he's not forgiven him. Because, to be fair, for King, in his defense, Gowther was a really shitty person for a while who did do some very shitty things, specifically to the person that he cares the most about. Although, it's worth noting, King's really setting himself up to be antagonistic towards, like, most of the seven deadly sins at this point. Like, he already hates Bond. Now he's kind of like, I hate you too, Gowther. Merlin, put on some pants. Lodius, your name is stupid. I don't like the British, whatever your name is. It's like, Escobar, why? I'm not even British. I mean, we're all kind of British. We're in Britannia. But Gowther.
So basically everyone except Diane.
Gowther, to his earnest defense, kind of accepts it. He's sort of like, yeah, I know. I've done some really shitty things. And King passes out, but he's like, I don't blame King. You know, I did very terrible things to Diane. And he seems to be okay with that because he also notes, I want to be a good doll. So I like that because it suggests that Gowther really has actually made a significant change. And while he's accepting the terrible things that he's done, he's not going to dwell on those. It seems like we're going to skip over that entire point of it, basically, and I really appreciate that.
Well, and also, he reads King's mind in order to tell what he's trying to get at. And so, you know, he sees less stuff like, you know, oh, Gowther, I hate you. But he's also got a bunch of different ideas floating around inside his mind. So part of him is, you know, just thinking about Diane. Part of him is thinking about his new wings. One of them is, I keep mistaking everyone's intentions, and one of them is, but I did the exact same thing. And yeah. Of course, yeah, he erased Diane's memories in the past, so the fact that Gowther did it, well, maybe that has to do with why he hates him so much.
Yeah. So, I do like that very much. And they're starting to kind of pull King away, because, as I said, he's already passed out because he's shit-faced, but in his, like, drunken, like, stumble... He knocks Escanar's glasses off, and he turns into his rage monster form, like, you cocky little brat! Like, essentially, like, fucking slaps. I guess maybe it's just King hits the ground and it happens, but I guess that is what happens. Because Gowther, like, dives him out of the way and then has to go for the glasses, but it fucking, like, just buffets King right in the face to the point where, like, he's got a bloody nose and shit. But they put the glass, Gowther puts the glasses back on Escanar, and he realized, like, Escanar explains, like, oopsie! that was a close one. These magic glasses suppress that, so it doesn't happen. Thanks for putting them back on. Probably should have told everybody about that more so ahead of time. Probably should have put a strap, to be honest. But yeah, they're carrying King out, and yeah, Escanar just says, well, I just hope King doesn't remember any of this. And our last little scene of this is Merlin, who is trying to locate Arthur. And in the process of doing this, she kind of contacts in with the evil Modius, whose name I'm forgetting off the top of my head right now.
Right.
And he sees the little eyeball scrying thing she's using and is just like, who are you? And Merlin's like, ah, shit. He blows it up, which would in turn affect her. And the guy basically says a response like, oh, not bad. You were able to escape my clutches. And we get this shot that at first I was like, oh my God, Merlin looks savage. And I was like, oh wait, hold on. I guess she wasn't really wearing much clothes to begin with. Like, it was somewhere I was like, oh my God, like she's barely holding it together. It's like, she has to be
more
fair.
It's more her posture than anything else.
Yeah, it's basically, well, it looks like one arm might be broken, but I'm like, it also could just be the way she's kind of hanging. But it was really like the first thought, I was like, oh my God, she's been savage. Like, I guess it's really just because it looks like a lot of her clothes are gone. And I guess that's really just because she's not wearing much to begin with.
I will admit, the first time I saw this panel, my initial reaction was, oh my God, what the fuck happened to Gowther?
yeah. So she was trying to find where Arthur was, and she can't, unfortunately. But I do like this
chapter. Concerns me. The fact that Arthur is missing concerns me far more than the fact that Merlin got the fuck snapped out of herself.
I like this chapter. It's kind of what I was hoping to get. I was hoping for maybe a little bit more wacky shenanigans, because there is still a little bit of heaviness to deal with here, but it's actually, I think, appropriate to have that, since it's a series with a lot of storylines kind of going on and should start making real headway towards. So I dug this chapter.
Well, and also there's kind of weird because the King stuff gets a bit of focus, but everything else is kind of breezed by really quickly. You know, Meliodas and Bond's little confrontation is over and done with right almost as soon as it begins. Diane and Elizabeth and Elaine are getting ready to drop some plot, and then it just kind of cuts off. So it sort of seems like there could have been like a couple of chapters focusing on this one, but I guess it's kind of Seven Deadly Sins style to move things along and just keep things moving pretty quickly. With that all done, all right, let's talk about Black Clover. So last time, Asta tapped into this ability to use the anti-magic in his sword, ascended to the top of the volcano. We see that everyone has managed to reach the summit. Everyone within the Crimson Lion Kings, as well as the other people that got dragged along by Maria Leona. So they're like, all right, so now everyone has my permission to soak in the hot spring. And so they're like, yes, awesome. And so Asta's like, huh. You know, we've got women here too, so is this, are we just gonna like do co-ed on this? And what's her face? I really should learn her name because she kind of takes a very, prominent, I guess, role in this chapter. Anyway, the member of the Charlotte's Nice group.
Blue Rose.
The Blue Rose group. Is like, I will not allow men to stare at Sis's pure naked body. It's like, all right, fair enough. She summons a partition in the hot springs with big old wall, and they're like, all right, you guys go over here, and the girl will go over here. Fair enough. Boobs!
Yes.
Boobs, 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 boobs.
There is a 2-page full spread of them all nude. Of course, you know, Barbie doll. It's, you know, none of the naughty parts are detailed.
No, it's steam, Chris, because they're in a hot spring. So there's steam just across their nipples and nothing else.
There is literally, we can see the steam, and it does not get anywhere near. It is not even at ankle. It doesn't even look at crotch height for Meliolona, who's the one actually in the water. And at one point, I was just like, you know, it's Jump, like, they'll do these things, but at other times, I was like, I do recall, like, there are those weird moments where Black Clover does get a little cheesecake. I don't know why, like, it's the Hot Springs episode, of course, you gotta get a little saucy in there. But what was those ones, like, I don't know why, like, I guess it didn't bother me, but I was just like, okay. I see what you're doing there, Black Clover. I see your game.
Yeah, so... Shit. It really hits you in the face. Especially because Mario Leona says the very obvious double entendre of the view's as good as ever.
And I'm like, curious as to how the view's as good as ever, because... from the context of the background around you right here, it looks like all you would see is crater, and I guess the sky. Like, I guess the night sky is nice, but you can always see the night sky. Like, it's not like you have to worry about that per se. So what is the view you see?
Also, I think that this chapter quite confirms that Maria Leona does not have magical enhancements. Flagrant. Like, there is so much. It just hits you with this full 2-page spread, but the next, hang on, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Next 6 pages are about the girls hanging out in the hot springs, and there's more cleavage and stuff shown beyond that point. So, let's go through this. So Charlotte gets in the water, and Sol, her knight is, holy shit, just like, drooling over her. And Shara's like, oh, the temperature's quite nice. And she's just like, oh, this isn't heaven. I don't know what is.
So, I mean, look. What are you going to do? You know, she has her feelings.
Shonen has a, I'm not going to say proud tradition of, like, lesbian characters just being massive goddamn perverts. Like, there's Soifun in Bleach. But then there's Chizuru in Bleach, who would just be like, oh shit, look at all them hot girls. Yeah. So, Mary Eliana is like, hey, Charlotte, you should have some liquor. And she's like, no, I really shouldn't. And then Sola's like, hey, you're a girl, Noelle, you should join our brigade. Let me wash your hair. It's totally not so I can like feel up on you or anything like that. She talks about the Blue Rose Knights in more detail, saying, oh, yes, we are almost all women. All our guys are errand boys. Men's rights in the Magic Knights Brigade need...
I can't believe they're having a showing for Wonder Woman that doesn't include guys.
Kofif would never allow this.
The injustice!
Just talk about all the current events at once. So,
you know what? I want to kind of get to something really quickly because I feel like the 2-page spread almost kind of broke us for a moment. I wouldn't really care, except this chapter I feel like was about to be really, like, after this feels really significant to me in a way because it deals very directly with Noelle and her parents.
And character background, yeah.
Like, to the point where I was like, this almost feels like this was something like if, like, we kind of joked about it before, but that notion of like, Noelle easily could be the main character of this series, like, she has the kind of, the traits and everything like that that would work for it. And this felt like a great kind of element to add if she were, like, the main character, like, this would be a plot point to, like, add in as it went along. And this was such a cool moment. Again, this is something I was hoping we'd get out of this arc is, like, development for people outside of, her Asta. But it comes all after all of, like, the cheesecakey, like, normal, like, hot spring shenanigans. And it's a jump thing. Like, it's not this, like, something exclusive to Black Clover. I'm sure there's plenty of other series that have had, like, you know, beach or hot springs or whatever episodes that, you know, are just joke. And then, like, hey, let's deal a little character development in there. But I don't know what, like, I was just, like, it was so, like, a weird whiplash where, I completely forgot that there even was the cheesecake in the chapter. Like, after, like, I finished reading, I was like, oh, it's cool. We got some stuff about Noelle. Really dug it. And then, like, as I was paging through this chapter for the recap, I was like, oh, what? Did this happen? Did I read a different chapter?
It was sandwiched in between tons of fan service as the judges were sandwiched between massive boobs last week. We get, like... Charlotte realizes, wait a minute, over there, that's where the men are bathing, meaning Yami's over there, nude! Which we'll say, like, if there are people out there who are into Yami's body type, that little Imagine panel right there first would probably definitely send some for you too. So this, imagining this caused her to basically just pass out in the water, which causes, after she's dragged up onto the shore, Soul's just like, ah, Captain, I can touch you, right?
The panel where she's face down the water, though, my only thought, I was just like, is anybody else really hungry for peaches? Like, it's just a joke that's always going to be in my mind whenever I see that kind of pose, like, in water. Maybe one of the most odd moments in Bleach history.
So then we get the actual, like, important part of the chapter, which is Mary Leona talking more with Noelle about her mother. Because Mary Leona mentions, you know, you actually look a lot like your mother. I think that she's implying with her hair up as opposed to naked. So Noelle starts asking questions about her because she says, no one ever talks about her to me. And so Leona says, she was strong, she helped me train, but I never once beat her, even though I've never lost the battlefield. And that's with my attribute giving me the advantage. The steel warrior princess who practically danced over battlefields. Ishir Silva. Her strength and beauty captivate everyone. Irasov Man Control really doesn't resemble her at all! but then she goes on to say, you know, for that reason, surpass her. You look like your mother, but surpass her with a strength that's all your own. And she kind of lovely punches her in the head. And it's like, oh, that's nice.
I hope, like, I want, like, the outtake version. Like, I know there aren't outtakes, but the outtake version is just like, so surpass her with a strength all your own.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to go in that hard. Are you okay?
I thought that was going for your forehead instead of your nose.
Oh, she is out. Oh, man. All right, we're going to have to take two. Makeup. You get rid of this black eye.
So the other slice of bread in this, character development, fan service sandwich is on the guy's side of the springs, which, okay, so we start off with Yuno and Leo. And Leo's like, you can't take this heat. Oh, it melts you. He's trying to boil the water around him. And, so then Leo's like, hey, wait a minute. You're cooling yourself off with wind. That's cheating. And Yuno's like, no, it isn't. You're using the magic to boil the water. It's like, yeah, what the fuck? This is the smartest thing I've seen Yuno talk about. So Yami is like, alright, that's a lame thing doing a hot spring. There are way better ways to enjoy them, you know. Anyway, let's whip out our dicks and measure them against each other.
Like, let's all just practice kissing. Like, wait, what? That's what the cool people do when they're in hot springs with other guys.
That's how you prove that you're a woman-loving straight guy is you make out with other guys.
You know what really hetero dudes do with one another when they're in hot springs? They start jerking each other off and see who can come last. That's what they all do.
Anyway, let's...
Then take pictures and don't talk about it afterwards.
Let's precurse this by sword fighting, and then one of us will wear a dress while the other one just kind of gropes them inappropriately. I mean, like a guy would do.
Yeah. It's not weird.
Anyway, let's go peep on the women. So... All the guys was like, oh, but if we peep on the girls, they'll kill us. And I was like, you guys are fucking wimps. If you were born a man, you do it, even if you have to risk your life. And Leo and the others are like, oh, yeah, let's be men, because they're fucking idiots. And he's like, all right, Mr. Cool, come on, you want to go see, right? And he was like, I'm not really, I'm a robot.
Robots have no need for seeing new genitalia. Procreation is not prime directive.
Yeah. So Yami's like, all right, little asshole, trying to look all cool, lousy, breezy, pretty boy, which I will admit is a fantastic nickname for Yuno. So Yuno's like, no, I'm not that kind of character. Please stop. Ow, 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 because he's squeezing his head. I do like how Yami then says, well, some people don't care what kind of character are, you loser.
Ouch.
But then Ass is like, well, no, he's actually really not interested. Ever since he was a kid, he's only ever bathed with guys. And you know, it's like, if you say that, people are going to misinterpret it. Leo then recalls that his brother also didn't really care to peep on girls either. And he would probably be really mad with him if he did that. But Yami's like, well, yeah, but if you want to surpass him, then you should follow your own path. And Leo's like, yeah, let's go peep on them. It's so fucking easy with this guy, isn't it? And then Yami's like, hey, Asta, you want to go do it too, right? And I think that this might literally be my favorite Asta moment that we've had so far in this series. Because Asta's like, no! My heart belongs to sister, so I refuse to look! And everyone's like, okay. Yeah. And it's like, Hot Springs Arc is done! What a weird chapter this was!
It is extremely weird, and I think I can admire it for certainly the comedic potential. It's definitely one that, like, upon finishing, I was just like, I'm very confused as to what this... I guess this accomplished Asta, like, getting more control over his power, and admittedly we did get a little bit of a focus on Noelle that I definitely do appreciate. I definitely sat there, though, afterwards and was like, I don't know why Yuno was evolved. I don't know why Fuego Leon, the younger one, some other variation of Fire Lion, I think, isn't it?
Fuego Leon is the older brother, and then Leo is the younger Leo. Brother.
So, like, I was like, they didn't really get anything. They didn't really do all that. Like, the other characters were just there to serve as the purpose of, like, jokes for this one, which I guess is fine, but it was like, man, it's really just, like, considering this was, like, 4 weeks, essentially, like, I was like, yeah, there's a lot of time spent on this when there's actually very little development out of it. And I guess it's fine if you look at it like it's a comedy, but, you know, Black Clover is ultimately a comedy series, so it was a little bit of a moment where I was just like, this is just strange. I don't know what happened here.
Yeah, it was a short break arc to get a little bit of character development in, but not a whole lot. It could have definitely been more done with it. I do definitely have an appreciation for this chapter in
the absurdity
just by itself. It is a Hot Springs episode, and so it's going to have fan service. That is something that, you know, I don't think, like, no shonen series that I've encountered that bothered to have a Hot Springs episode did not include fan service. It's an obligation to follow that. But you get your Hot Springs, you get your comedy, and then you get the peeping thing, which is then just aborted. And the fact that it's happened so suddenly did really actually get me. It was like, oh, I guess we're not going to go through that little dog and pony show. So
it is legitimately very amusing to me that it's just like, Ask, you come with us? No, my heart belongs to sister. Okay, credits.
I was just like,
it's like, all right.
I do like how they, like, they're not giving him shit like they do with Yuno. He's not trying to talk him into like doing the others. Everyone's just kind of like, you know, maybe we shouldn't mess with that. He's really fucking out of it.
Like, everyone's just like, all right, fucking, I hate this weird little kid, but whatever. I'm not going to fight him. Credits. All right, before we move on to One Piece, I need to address this because we have Jeff in the chat, and he has been hinting at something several times and just posted a cryptic remark about it on Twitter. And he was hinting on it very heavily in the chat, and I didn't quite get it at first. I thought, like, he should have been direct, all right? I don't get your fucking subtlety, Jeff, at times, because I hadn't downloaded the update. But he was mentioning very frequently during our discussion on Astro Lost in Space, he's like, man, it'd be really great if I could read this on my phone. Oh, man, if only I could read Astro on my phone. The reason he's mentioning that is because the Shonen Jump app just updated, and now, from your phone, you can read the new free manga chapters that they put out, which includes things like Astra, which includes, you know,
the sample opening chapters, yeah.
Eld Live, Dragon Ball Super, Boruto, those free chapters that are put out, and I believe new ones are put out daily. So if you have the Jump app, go check it out, download it, get your free chapters. If you have not read Astra, you could read it there. Jeff, in the future, less subtlety. We're blunt people here, all right? I'm dumb, all right? My dad didn't play catch with me.
Even on release, it's just like, fucking hell, Jeff, just say it.
Well, because for a while, I was like, he's really, like, aren't you the one that made it? Like, aren't you the one who works on the app? Why are you complaining so much about it?
All right, let's move on to One Piece, goddammit. Chapter 866, Natural Born Destroyer, a.k.a. Nature versus Nurture. So, we get Charlotte Linlin's backstory, going to when she was a 5-year-old. The caption on her introduction actually flat out says, human, age 5, even though she is fucking towering over her parents. So, basically what we get is her parents are just like, she is really too much trouble. Like, not even in terms of, like, oh, God, raising a kid is hard, but in terms of, Jesus Christ, this kid destroys everything around her. We're going to just leave her here. Bye! And they pretend that they're going to come back for her.
I can't remember which person said it, and I think it was actually a retweet of the One Piece podcast that I saw it from. But the notion of Charlotte is essentially Elmira from Tiny Toons. She just loves and loves, yeah. But she crushes everything she touches.
That's basically it. Exactly. She doesn't know her own strength, and she is very forceful with trying to force things to get along. So we see her being abandoned, and she does wait patiently as the seasons change and random giant walruses come by.
I don't know why. This just made me laugh thinking about it. I totally forgot that there was this one time in Rugrats where there was supposed to be the notion of, like, a bunch of time passing in it. Like, it was, like, a shot of the house outside, and you saw, like, sun, and the next shot it's, like, a bunch of rain, and the next shot you see, like, falling leaves coming from the ground, and then it's snow. Like, there's, like, the idea being, like, oh, like, a year's passed. But if, like, the next shot, it's just like, oh, hey, Stu, crazy weather this week, hasn't it? And like, yeah, I like looking around. As a kid, never appreciated the joke. As an adult, I fucking, I'm like, that is hysterical.
That's great. We had a bunch of exposition dumped on us. So I'm just going to, like, read this off really quickly. The giant warriors who terrorized the world over 100 years in the past, but when the two captains of the giant pirate suddenly vanished, they passed into legend. After that, several of the remaining members, careless after the loss of their leaders, wound up captured by the Navy and sentenced to death, until the appearance of a wandering holy woman. Her name was Sister Carmel. Suddenly, storm clouds rolled in. And, basically, there was a tremendous omen, and it looked as though it was a sign from God, and, she told everyone that they were going to execute the giants. The warriors of Elbaf will band together again if you kill those men, and they will swear a vengeance upon humanity. So forgive their crimes. I will show you the way. I will guide you to a brighter world where all peoples can join hands and laugh together. In time, she became Mother Carmel, and she found an orphanage called the House of Lambs that took in children without anywhere else to go, regardless of their status or race. Okay. So, very important information that gets all dropped right there. So,
yes.
So, time has gone by. She's now, like, a much more elderly woman when she actually first meets Lin-Lin. And so, when she meets her, Lin-Lin's initial thing is, like, you know, because she says, oh, you know, you'll be friends with all these children. We'll take care of you. You live with them in happiness until your parents come back. And Lin-Lin's like, okay, thanks. I'm hungry.
Hey, fair enough.
And we get a little bit of, like, information of, like, oh, you know, this kid is a prince who was chased from his lands. He's still wearing his fucking crown.
It was, like, two designs between him and the kid that they, like, have a comment over about, like, children who almost fell into slavery that I'm like, I wouldn't be surprised if in time we see that these characters have grown up and we, like, right. See their designs. Because they have a, like, distinct enough design, and I'm almost like, Oda could definitely do something with that.
Yeah. Or the little frickin', what is it, what's the frickin' shooty thing in Mario?
Shy Guy?
But the one that shoots pellets out at you. Yeah. Look, there's a kid who's wearing one of those. It's like, Jesus Christ, look at that kid. Anyhow, so she lived in peace. Yay. Everyone got along with her fairly well. But then she found out there was a bear and a wolf fighting the woods, so she put them in the same cage together. But then Mr. Bear ate Mr. Wolf. It was very naughty, so I smacked him and killed him. So, we see this idea built up over the course of the chapter that, she's kind of a good kid, but he really understands her except for Mother Carmel. And second off, she does definitely seem to have the potential to just be evil despite whatever situation she's in. Cause she's a very gluttonous child and, turns out she's quite greedy when we find out at the end. And, you know, there's examples that we see every here and there. Like, she sees someone from the Long Arm tribe. She's like, he's got an extra joint, so I was going to rip it out for him. No! No!
It's interesting you say that, because there's definitely a lot you can glean from this chapter. And I feel like we do need to see what next week's chapter, because we're not done with the flashback. And there's, I think, a very vital information we need to kind of get from next week's. But perhaps they'll save us for the end after we get to through the chapter, because there's a lot still to kind of discuss, and I don't want to kind of push us ahead too far.
Right. So, yeah. Carmel kind of forgave all the misunderstandings that happened with Lin-Lin. She understood she was just kind of naive. Eventually, the warriors of Elbaf set up a new home, and they ended up welcoming Lin-Lin and many others to live among them. And so at this point, Lin-Lin learns that there is a winter solstice fast, a 12-day fast that Elbaf engages in each year during the winter solstice. And so Lin-Lin's like, oh, but I'm going to be so hungry. And this young giant girl who is with her promises, no, well, there's going to be a feast afterwards if you make it through that. We then cut over to see that a young Hadrodin is off training, trying to, you know, realize his dream of reviving the giant pirate crew, like we would see later on.
I do,
which
like
is a nice detail
little,
to include. Yeah,
I do like that little touch.
I also like how he dresses the exact same as he would when he's an adult.
He actually seemed more distinct in design as a child than as an adult.
He does, actually, yeah, because I like the way that the helmet looks on him as a little kid. But he receives, let's see here. Who the fuck is Raiden?
The Thunder God, Nick, from Mortal Kombat? Come on.
No, that's Raiden. Who the fuck is Raiden? Are they talking to Hadrodin? Whatever. So, old ass giants show up, but you can tell that they're old because their beards reach their fucking feet. They're the Beard Falls, Jarul and Jorul. And they are
Nick,
former pirate captains.
It's Jorul and Jarul, of course.
Jarul.
Jarul. Those hips mesmerize. What are you going to do?
So, they're like, hey, you know, we agree with, you know, Carmel's, ideas about trade over plunder, but we should not forget the fact that we're warriors. We need to keep those traditions alive. So they give Hadrodin some encouragement about this. They're like, hey, where are you guys going? Oh, we are going to eat Simla at the village. We've come to call on the children at the House of Lambs. Oh, hello, Linden.
What, Simla?
And the little girl was just like, it's a sweet, it's a delicious treat. And eating Simla before the fast gives us lots of nutrients. It's a sweet cream dot inside sweet bread with marzipan. They're both going, ah, yeah, it's so delicious. So Charlotte eats the Simla, and she doesn't stop eating it. It's so delicious that she can't hold herself back. And they're like, hey now, you can't eat so much. We're not going to have enough for everybody. And she's like, oh, it's so yummy. A few days go by as they go into the fast. And Linda's like, I'm starving to death. And Carmel's like, hey, now, come on. You know, you can endure this. And afterwards, you know, everything's going to be fine. And, you know, the harder the fast is, the deeper our gratitude is to the sun. And Luna says, promises, I'll try and keep trying. I'll endure this. Time keeps on going by. And she's like, I'm getting so skinny. No, you're not.
It reminds me of another Nickelodeon joke. I can't tangent it again. Angry Beavers. So, it's great.
They get it halfway through the fast and Gerd, there we go. That's her name. The little girl, comes running for Mother Carmel. And she's like, it's Linlin. And we see Charlotte standing in a destroyed village with dead warriors surrounding her while the town seemingly, I think it's burning. Yeah, it is. It definitely is. And Mario Kama's like, oh, Linlin, what are you doing? And she's like, bring me Simla! And, one of the Beard Falls says, you have made a terrible mistake, Linlin. You do not have the right to thank the sun. Even a child can only be forgiven for so much. And he prepares to strike her down, pulling his sword back while Mother Carmel tries to intervene. And he says, I'm sorry, Carmel. She only looks on the child. On the inside, she is a god of disaster.
So this is a very surprising chapter. I would not have kind of expected this to be what we're going to get out of Charlotte. And I really, really enjoyed what we got out of here because this is a very unique situation that's brought up. And this is one thing I've kind of enjoyed about One Piece is that many of the villains have gotten some level of narrative to them that suggests a little bit more than I'm just an evil dude. Like we kind of had a theme that's run, you know, let's see, but One Piece of Dreams, but that Crocodile kind of seemed like he was somebody who had dreams at one time and they fell apart. And Gecko Moria has talked about how he was at one time a pirate like Luffy before he lost his crew to Kaido and kind of became what he did after that. We've had these notions that there's more complicated stories behind them, and sometimes we delve a little bit more into them or just tease to them, and maybe we'll get it addressed later. This is one that's a little bit more forefront with this, essentially, because this is happening kind of concurrently with the actual narrative of Straw Hats against Big Mom. And I like this story. It's a very unique kind of tale that Lin-Lin, as a child, does seem to be generally earnestly a nice kid. You know, she is unintentionally destructive. She has an insane amount of power to the point where you're just like, how the fuck does this even work? Like, you're punching out bears and you're not, like, you're just supposed to be a human. I don't know what's happening here. But it is something I like, that she's this destructive child and her parents have abandoned her. Nobody seems to be willing to take her in, but this Mother Carmel sees who she is and is understanding her. She keeps kind of helping her along when other people would condemn her and try to push her away. And I do like this idea that she sees something beyond. She actually seems to understand who Charlotte is at her core. And that's why I say it's very significant to see what's going to happen next week, because the ending of this chapter, obviously, she didn't get her fucking Selma, so she temper tantrumed and apparently destroyed the village and is being insinuated as being a god of destruction. And we've gotten some hints to that as being a reality, because they've mentioned that Big Mom, when she throws her tantrums, just destroys everything. But I'm very curious, because the implication we get, especially when there's the one message that says Lin-Lin truly loved Mother Carmel, suggests that maybe, like characters like Crocodile or Gecko Moria, that there is a legitimate kind of maybe goodness, or perhaps there is a potential for it in Big Mom that was lost because of these events. And I'm curious about that.
It seems to be somewhere in the realm of Doflamingo's flashback, a little bit more sympathetic than that, because we see that, you know, she has that, there's more of an emphasis on the potential for goodness in her, as opposed to the fact that, you know, Doflamingo was just an evil kid from the beginning. Mm-hmm. But there, you know, it does help to definitely flesh out the villains to see, like, hey, you know, yes, there is definitely something really bad and messed up about these people, but they are, you know, actual people. There are characters in this world, and that she had a point where she wasn't quite the person that she is now. And also, it does a very good job of explaining why Big Mom is so attached to the image of Mother Carmel. It really does carry through, like, hey, you know, in this entire world where nobody got her, this woman would forgive her for everything. Of course she loved her that much. And also, it attaches it in a very childlike way. Oh, she always forgave my tantrums and stuff. So it establishes really how immature she is. So
I would say that there are some details from this that do make me a little bit intrigued to see where the next chapters go, because I think this would definitely make sense for why her dream is to have a table where everyone's at the same eye level, because it would kind of speak to that idea of being able to, like, see eye to eye with everyone to understand them, kind of like she had. But this does also kind of almost go against her in a way, because we know that she kind of has favorites with their children. Like, yeah, she pointed out and constantly used to ridicule Pudding for having a third eye. And it's like, maybe that's just developed over time. But you think with
we see in this that she thinks that there are people who just are wrong. I'll take out this fishman's gills. I'll take out this third limb. So I think that the implication is that even as she matures and understands more and wants to know more about the tribes, she still has this idea that some things are just wrong, because she still has that immature perception of them.
I would say if the end conclusion we get to this is that perhaps Big Mom realizes what's kind of become of her and how everything's kind of gone, if there's a legitimate kind of moment where she realizes and feels bad for the way she's treated some of her kids, if that's the reason why we're not just had to stick with Pudding being evil, that I'm perfectly cool with, because that's actually a good story in my mind. And I guess we're kind of have to see how things go from here. But I really did enjoy what this chapter is moving us towards.
Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, I do really like that she's got this kind of way of carrying on Mother Carmel's way of doing things, but she really doesn't seem to understand the side effects of the way that she's going on about it, which goes back to the way that she was as a kid. So, mm-hmm. What if she dies in this flashback and the future Big Mom is a clone? We've gotten so many suggestions about what if X is a clone during the chat since we talked to Master. What if the sword is a clone? It's been a fun episode, and definitely some big bombs being dropped in manga this week, but we're gonna wrap things up now. It's getting late and we gotta go, so we'll catch you guys later. This has been Weekly Manga Recap. Let's name our favorites for this week.
Yes. I will give my favorite chapter of the week to... I'm going to give it to, actually, Astra Lost in Space. I think One Piece was a strong contender for it, but I'm going to give it to Astra just because that is a chapter that really kind of puts a lot of intriguing notions ahead of me, and I'm really excited for that.
I'm right there with you. If there weren't too many particularly strong chapters this week, and it felt like Astra was the one that stood out in comparison to the series the most. So, yeah, I'm right there with you on that.
And for my character of the week, I'm going to give it to Big Mom, Charlotte Linlin, if you want to go that way. I like what this chapter is doing to kind of develop this character and place a more interesting thought in my mind about who she's going to be. I was worried that I'd find her one of the least interesting One Piece villains. I think now she might end up being one of the ones right along with, alongside some of the best.
I'm going to go with Mirio from My Hero Academia because, uh-huh. I mean, yeah, he had a cool moment where he stepped up as a hero and as a leader that actually was really cool.
Awesome.
All right. That done. Yeah. So we are going to finish up here. You can check us out again next week on twitch.tv/RoloT and smashcast.tv/RoloT. We're going to record the show hopefully again Wednesday around 7 p.m. Eastern time. But if things need to change, you can follow us on Twitter to stay updated on stuff. At WMR Podcast is the official Twitter account for the show. At RoloT and at Whatever Roller of Time are your two co-hosts. You can also check out our past episodes on weeklymugrecap.podbean.com as well as on our YouTube channel and on iTunes. And if you do that on iTunes, be sure to leave us a rating and a comment so that you can help us beat the woodworkers in the hobby section. If you've got something to say, if you want to share with us just some basic feedback, if you want to ask us a question for us to answer in a Q&A episode of the show, or if you just want to suggest a future manga for us to read, you can send all that stuff to weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com, and we will parse through that. And, hey, we might take your suggestion.
Absolutely.
Special thanks, Squatch. Go ahead.
Go ahead. You're about to get to it.
All right. Special thanks go out to our Patreon supporters. Your support allows us to create all sorts of bonus content for you guys to enjoy. We just did our bonus episode for the month of May, which, as Chris talked about earlier, is a weekly manga recap blues. We talked about a bunch of the newer series that we added into the recap recently, as well as, Promised Neverland, because we couldn't pass it up.
It was too fun. It was legitimately a ton of fun. I would highly recommend you check it out. If you want to catch snippets of it and like a taste of it before you go in, I believe the Weekly Manga Recap Twitter account should have some couple clips that you can just listen to. But I want to also give special thanks to Thomas Owens, William Perez, Lucas Ibister, and Malene Sundby Holt, who are our newest patrons. Thank you very much, guys. Boosh, fist bump for the support. We greatly appreciate it.
And special thanks to the guys who helped us make the podcast. What is Steve Mann, our title card artist, and Infamous Planet, who has made the frame for us and is looking to getting back into making more visual editions about now.
Yes. I love, we're not going back and fix it, but I love so much Infamous Planet is here and gets off to hearing his name, and you robot it out the entire time you just mentioned specifically the Infamous Planet stuff. I know it wasn't planned, but... Mwah, it was perfect. All right.
Oh, there's his reaction to it. All right. That's going to do it, guys. We'll catch you all later.
Yeah, no time for a wacky send-off. Although I probably would have had time if my dad played catch with me. Boom, nailed it right in there. Hot dog.